Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. Here today from his home in Half Moon Bay on the Pacific Ocean is Jack Castor, a former engineer and legendary man who did a solo bike ride across the United States on a high-wheel bike, survived a famous high-speed crash on one, has traveled the world meeting high-wheel celebrities, and owns many cars, antiques, and other collectibles. So how are you doing today, Jack?
I'm doing fine.
Great. Before we get into your high-wheel escapades, what kind of work were you doing before you became a high-wheel rider and an antique collector?
Well, I worked in the aerospace industry, and I worked for Lockheed and Sperry, which became Honeywell, for the most part, but I did spend a year and a half right at the beginning of my career with General Dynamics down in San Diego on the Atlas missile program.
So you worked in Palo Alto, is that correct?
I've worked a little bit in Palo Alto, well, quite a bit, but some of the time when I worked for Lockheed, I worked in Sunnyvale.
Okay, and so were you an engineer?
And I even worked in a hospital down in San Jose or Santa Clara one time.
Oh, you did?
Lockheed got a... They got a study contract to figure out how to help a major hospital convert from paperwork to a computer system, whereby a doctor could just order care or medicines for a patient on a computer screen, and so he didn't have to fill out all these forms and have duplicates and triplicates going to the pharmacy and the attending nurse and maybe other doctors and the file and all that, so they could do it on a computer. So I was one of a team sent into a hospital, and we surveyed. We walked the rounds and surveyed what people were doing with their time. It was a study to see how people were using their time in the hospital. Some would be administering to a patient, some would be filling out a form, some would be sitting around having coffee on a break and so forth. And then Lockheed was able to recommend how to put in a computer system and streamline operations in the hospital.
So the defense contractor, Lockheed, did that type of work, huh?
You bet. Yeah, Lockheed was a virile company. They got into all kinds of things. Lockheed Missiles and Space Company was part of a big corporation that had major plants in L.A. and Marietta, Georgia, where they build airplanes. But here at Sunnyvale, we actually got to build an airplane for the Army. We built submarines for the Navy, rescue and search submarines. All kinds of things. I worked on a program where we did a healthcare system for a Papago Indian Reservation down near south of Tucson.
Wow!
Yeah, it was a great company.
Wow! So were you living in Half Moon Bay at the time?
Part of the time. Started out. Well, when I first moved to the area and started working for Lockheed, I actually lived up in San Francisco for a few weeks. I think 3 months.
Huh.
It was a long drive to work. but then I lived in Palo Alto, Mountain View, Sunnyvale, Milpitas, and then finally I got over here to Half Moon Bay and stayed until I went to Phoenix.
Okay, so for those listeners in other parts of the world that don't know where Half Moon Bay is located, it's on the other side of the Coast Range from the San Francisco Bay Area, about, 24 miles, is that what you had?
Yeah, that's what I used to clock from home to work.
Okay.
Now, we're right down the coast, about 25 miles south of San Francisco. We're right on the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
But we're separated from most civilization by a coastal range of hills, which are only 1,000 to 2,000 feet high. But it's just enough to make the people on the eastern side of those hills think that we're almost in another world over here.
And that whole other world is because of the fact that you guys live in lots of fog.
Well, summer we get the frog, the fog. The marine fog comes in, and until the sun gets to work and burns it off, we'll have fog. But some days the fog stays all day. Now, in the wintertime, we get our clearest weather. The fog stays well offshore, and rainstorms pass through. This year, we're not getting a whole lot of rain. In fact, today's a beautiful, clear day.
It's beautiful there, huh?
Yep.
Really? Wow. Huh.
And then, of course, the air is cleaner than what you have on your side of the hill.
Oh, indeed. Okay, so, Jack, you're a high-wheel cyclist. When did you get into high-wheel bikes?
I think it was 1977.
Okay.
Being an engineer, I was interested in mechanical things, and I'd been collecting old telephones. I have some of the old oak wall telephones. I have the candlesticks and several other different kinds. So I had the phones. I had a couple of old typewriters, a couple of old radios with tubes in them, and an old treadle sewing machine, and my thoughts turned to the bicycles. I did.
Okay. So 1977, you got your first high-wheel bicycle. Then it seems, 7 years later, you rode one across the United States? Is that what I understand to be correct here?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. What was your first high-wheel bike? What kind of bike did you get? What was the first one? What brand?
Well, it turned out to be an English bike made by the Hillman, Herbert & Cooper Company, and they called it Premier.
Hmm. Wow. That was your first one, huh?
Yeah, but not for very long, because I had joined the Wheelman Club, and I went to their national meet with the intent to buy two high-wheel bicycles, one the conventional type with a big wheel in the front, little wheel in the back, and the other a star bicycle that has a little wheel in the front and the big wheel behind. And when I got to the meet, I was able to find this Premier and buy it. And I had made inquiries and found out where I could get a star. So a week later, I had acquired a star as well.
Hmm. Okay, so you had two high-wheel bikes. You rode a Columbia across the United States, an Columbia Expert, is that correct?
That's right, a 52-inch Expert.
52-inch Expert. And let's talk about that ride just a little bit. What was your daily average? How many miles did you ride a day?
Well, it averaged 75.
Okay.
Now, there were good days and there were bad days. There were 12 days when I did 100 miles in a day, which we call a century.
Holy criminy.
And across Wyoming, I had a very strong tailwind, and I knocked out centuries 5 days in a row.
Wow. Okay.
There was another day that I only did 8.5 miles because I was up in the Sierras, and someone had arranged for a newspaper, a mayor, and a TV coverage to come up out of Sacramento, and I had to be available for that. So It was about 12:30, just after lunch, when the TV guy was finally done with me, and I started out. Well, I went up to Gold Run and I went up to Dutch Flat and did my daily mailing out of Gold Run. And in Dutch Flat, I was given it was arranged for me to have a free meal at a restaurant up there. And after that, I stopped in to see the highway patrol, and they told me I couldn't go over the top. There wasn't enough time left in the day. And there was a storm up above me in the Sierras, and they said, "We're not going to let you go, because in order to survive, you're going to have to break into somebody's property up there, a cabin, because you don't have time to get over the top, and you're not going to find motels up there." So the cops actually arranged for me to stay in Alta, a small town, a village, in fact. So I only got in 8.5 miles that day. But the next day, I was determined to get over, and I got up early, and it was very, very cold. I think, it was below freezing. So I had newspaper under my clothes and to keep me warm, and I did 73 miles and rode into Reno at the end of that day in snow flurries.
Hmm. And was that uphill riding that you did?
That was a lot of uphill walking and riding over the Donner Summit.
Huh, wow. Now, you rode from San Francisco to Boston, and you retraced the route that Thomas Stevens took when he went across the United States in 1884. the 100-year celebration of that. What was the hardest part of that ride, Jack? Tough question, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it was a lot of tough going through the Sierras, a lot of walking, because I wasn't in my top condition at that point. I was breaking in the saddle, which was really causing me some trouble, and a lot of walking. When you walk for an hour with a bike uphill, I got a pain in the back of my neck. Mm-hmm. It's something to do with your posture while you're pushing this heavy bike up the hill. There was another particularly hard time in Nevada when the headwind was so strong. This was out around Fernley. I actually got off the bicycle and walked for an hour because the wind was taking so much energy out of me that I figured it was going to be easier to walk than to pedal. I got rained on around Cleveland. I really got doused one time, and I just cut that ride short and took a motel.
Okay.
But other than that, I don't remember many particular problems. There was some walking, coming out of Salt Lake City. I walked uphill for an hour too.
Huh. Okay. And you rode. We'll come into that because we're going to talk about your crash. But you rode a lot of downhill with your legs over the bars. Let's talk about that in a little bit. Before we talk about that, how old were you when you did this ride?
47.
47. Wow. 47 years old, you're riding across the United States like a kid. That's amazing.
Yeah, well, there have been guys that have been considerably older have done it, too. It's, mm-hmm. You know, I'm not, I'm only 5'6", 5'6 and a half, 150 pounds, and I'm not an unusual athlete, and I figure, hey, anybody can look at me and say, hell, if that guy can do that, I can do that too. And I think there are millions of people in this country can do what I did. It just takes a little determination and the time to get away and do it and a little bit of money.
Well, thanks for that, Jack. How about cars? How much traffic did you hit?
I only really had two cars that annoyed me. It was like about the third day here. One, two. I think about my third day, some old buzzard in a pickup truck shaved me really close, and then I could see him looking in his mirror to see whether I was going to crash off the side of the road. It really came close to my handlebars unnecessarily. It was a two-lane road, and there was no traffic coming the other way. And then in Wyoming, which is not a heavily populated state, you know, some guy blew his horn and scared me pretty well. And that was on a wide open highway where he could see for a mile and could have been driving in the left-hand lane. Mm-hmm. But I guess some motorists don't like cyclists, and some people are mischievous like that truck driver was. I never took a fall on the whole ride, and I never got a cramp on the whole ride.
All right. Now, when I talked about traffic, did you ride any cities, per se?
Especially, it was legal for me to go on the freeway across Nevada. Mm-hmm. But except when you come to cities such as Reno, mm-hmm. There are signs on the freeway, and I had to exit and go through city streets, yes.
Hmm. And stoplights, the whole nine yards of that stuff then, huh, on the high wheel?
Yep.
Yeah. So were you ready for that?
Was I what for that?
Were you able to do that? Was that a problem for you at all?
Oh, yeah. 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 There was one point in New York, I remember I was on a steep hill, and there was a sign there that during the Civil War, Colonel Branch had been killed at that point. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I was being followed about 5 weeks behind me were eight other guys riding across America. And one of those guys was named Branch.
Yeah.
I hope he got to see that particular sign.
Huh.
It was a hill that was too steep to let the bike go safely. So I weaved back and forth. It was a two-lane road with no traffic. And I weaved back and forth across the road until I'd gone a couple hundred yards. And then I could see far down the hill, and I could, I judged it was safe. And then I went into my coasting mode with legs over the bars and my hand on the brake. And it didn't get away from me. The speed was controllable. But what I found out was when I got down to the bottom of this hill, I came into a village, and I was confronted with a four-way stop sign intersection, and I had a deuce of a time getting that bike stopped in front of that stop sign.
Wow. Wow. Again, we're going to come back to Barzo because that's real exciting. Feet over, I should say. How many, you did this ride, you stayed in hotels, but you didn't carry a sleeping bag with you?
That's right, I didn't.
Didn't carry a sleeping bag.
I mostly stayed in motels a good three-quarters of the time. I did manage to stay with a brother in Davenport, Iowa, overnight, and there were just a couple of people I knew that I stayed with, and sometimes strangers would offer me housing for the night.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, that wasn't particularly advantageous. It saved me money,
mm-hmm.
but it meant that I had to spend time that evening
entertaining.
Yeah,
right.
Discussing the ride with these people.
Right.
Whereas when I was alone, I was able to do what I did every night, and that was I washed clothing because
mm-hmm.
I had two sets of clothing, the pair on me, the set on me, and the set in the bag.
Mm-hmm.
So I washed clothing every night. I inspected the bike, cleaned it up. Some days you rode in a little bit of drizzle, and the bike would get pretty gritty, and I'd clean it up. I would write a letter, an 8.5 by 11, front and back, to a girlfriend, and that was the record of my ride. And I also sent a postcard to the guys at work, because they'd been kind enough to take me out to lunch, and take up a little collection for me. And I said, okay, well, I'll send you a postcard every day, and I did. And I got the whole set back at the end of the ride, and I think they got their money's worth because they put maps all around my cubicle, and they had stick pins in it, and they were actually running a little pot on or whatever, a little gambling thing on how far I'd go each day.
Wow.
Even my boss would drop by and see, where is he now? How's he doing?
How exciting. Wow. Okay, now you crashed going, 30, 40 miles an hour on your high wheel bicycle after the ride. How many years ago was that crash that took place?
Oh, that crash was just about, I don't know, 3 years ago.
3 years ago. And that was in New Zealand? Is that?
Yeah, that was in New Zealand. We don't really know how fast I was going. I might estimate 30, but I might have pulled it back down to 25.
Mm-hmm.
I was going down a hill that I'd actually coasted a couple of years before. We were taking a tour with maybe 10 or 12 high wheel bicycle riders, and this time they had a film crew along, young man and a woman, and the man was filming out of. It was a hatchback car, so he had the hatch up, and he could film right out the back end of the car, and the girl was driving. And they asked me if I was going to coast that hill, and I said, sure, I've done it before. And I'm not the only guy who's done it either. And so we waited till most of the riders had gone, and then I started down the hill. And I just let it go for a while, and it got into what we call a speed wobble, where the wheel is hunting. It's going side to side to side. And I think that's from the weight of the cranks and pedals pulling the wheel side to side.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was into that condition, which is unnerving. And some people say if you have the nerve to let it go faster that you go through that, but I've never let them go that fast. So I applied the brake lightly and brought the speed down a few miles an hour to where this oscillation was acceptable. And so I was stable and comfortable. I guess I started hearing the noise of the rim of the bike on the road. It had, the tire had come off. And I looked down to find out what was going on, and because up at that time all the problem was the noise. So what is this? And if you look back when you're riding a bike or a motorcycle, the bike tends to bank, I guess. And so while I was looking down and determining that my tire was off, the bike was starting to bank over to the left, and when I looked back up, I straightened it up, and the bike turned to the right and went right across the road and headed for the shoulder. And I don't know if I made it go over or it went over on its own. I probably made it go over, but I don't remember that. But I do remember when it was going over, my thought was, roll. And I landed on my feet, went to my knees, because there was no way I could run as fast as that bike was going. And so I went on over, rotated over, and went onto my right shoulder and rolled. And the bike flew right over the top of me, and I ended up on the grass alongside the road.
In a heap. Just for those who don't know, what we're talking about can be found at bikeroute.com. If you click on High Wheel and go to the famous Jack's Crash site, you'll see what Jack's talking about here. And as a basic overview of what you'll see, when Jack rides a bike and he coasts downhill, he puts his feet over the handlebars. Now, mind you, Jack's, what, you're up 7 feet, 8 feet in the air when all this is taking place?
Well, your head's about 6 feet up.
Six or 7 feet. And so you're way high off the ground. Your feet are over the bars. And I exhort you to get a look at that that footage. Again, bikeroute.com. Click on the high wheel section and go to Jack's Crash, which is pretty famous for this internet, at least internet famous for this crash, and it's spectacular. So so what happened to you, Jack? What happened after that crash?
Well,
damages to you and damages to the bike.
Yeah, I was lying on my back on the side of the road. The bike had come over top of me, and it was alongside of me. And well, the first thing I thought was to check and see whether I had any broken bones. And I was able to move both my arms and both my legs. And so I was satisfied I wasn't seriously injured. And I think I was in shock. An overwhelming feeling of fatigue washed over me. And the last thing I wanted to do was get up. I just wanted to lie there for a while. And since a bright sun was shining right in my eyes, I just closed my eyes, man, after I checked my limbs, and I just lay still. There were still a couple of people behind me that I'd passed on the way down, and they came up, and pretty soon, well, the camera crew was there, and pretty soon there were 8 or 10 people around, and they were checking me out. I had cyclist gloves on that the fingers stick out of the gloves. The fingers on the gloves are cut short, so all of my fingers were bleeding. They weren't too bad. The doctor put one stitch in on one finger, but the rest he just put Band-Aids on them. I had a chunk of meat out of the top of my left knee, about the size of a half dollar. And that was fairly serious, but the funny thing was they didn't even discover that when they were making a check of me on the ground there. The other stocking had a big hole in it, but the one where I was damaged, the breeches and the stocking didn't reveal that there was any damage over there. So they took me on down to a clinic, and we caught a doctor 15 minutes before he was going to leave, and he checked me out, and he took a look at that knee and squeezed the skin together, and he says, "Oh, well, we can just sew that together." So he just told a nurse to clean me up, and so they put 3 stitches in the knee skin and 1 in a finger, and no antibiotics and no painkillers of any kind, and released me. And that knee was very badly traumatized. It had a lot of pain inside the knee, I really couldn't walk worth a darn or get in and out of a car. I had to get a cane, and 2 weeks later, bam, I was good as new.
Wow. Marathon man. Bionic man.
There wasn't a scratch on the helmet. My head didn't slam into the ground. I don't think my head touched the ground until I was all done.
Hmm. So at what point, how much longer after that, were you back on a bicycle?
Well, it was 2 weeks after that that I could finally go up and down steps decently. I probably didn't get back on the bike for a month after the accident.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Is that still with you today? Do you still think about that every time you ride?
Only if I start going down a hill pretty fast, then I start wondering, where will I go if the tire comes on? Will I go to the right or the left?
Right.
And I tend to hold the speed down.
Mm-hmm.
The bicycle was damaged lightly. The leather saddle had a scuff on it, and the rim of the bike was replaced because that really suffered the most damage. The bike was repaired with a new rim,
Was it cosmetic damage, Jack, on the rim?
No, it was bent, and it looked like somebody took a really rough file to it.
Wow. Huh. Okay, so Jack, let's talk about your cars. Okay, now you've got a Ferrari. Is it a Sunbeam? Is that what that three-wheeled car is?
No, that's a Messerschmitt.
A Messerschmitt. And you've got a Model A. What else have you got over there that people might identify with?
Well, 62 Corvette, and then couple of Alpha Spiders, a Triumph TR3, an Apollo Roadster, and a couple of BMW 507s.
God. And you've got a motorcycle?
Yeah, there's a Norton.
A Norton, okay. And
a player Norton.
Okay. You've also got in your home, let's talk about the bikes you've got in your home. You've got, how many high wheels do you own now?
I think 13.
13 high wheels. 13. God. And then how many bikes total? You've got other bikes there. You've got
maybe 55.
Okay, now you traded one of your bicycles, a Waverly, to Prior Dodge for a bicycle hub lamp, of all things. Tell us about that bike.
Well, I bought the bike at an antique show in the Cow Palace. A dealer had it up there. The tires, of course, were shot, but the bicycle was in original condition with regard to its paint. It had a maroon paint with gold striping. It had polished wooden handlebars, a wooden chain guard, and wooden rims. It had its leather tool bag on it that still had the word Waverly tooled into the leather, and the saddle still had Waverly tooled into that, and the nickel plating was still pretty good, and it had a dress guard on it, I believe. Yeah, so it was a very nice original ladies bike from Indianapolis, and I bought it and put some nice new single tube tires on it, and well, it turned out that Prior Dodge, who's a collector from New York, had spent many years in Paris, and he had the original advertising poster for the Waverly, and the bike and the poster were displayed in Tucson, and then he went to work on, he wanted that bike, and I told him, well, I wanted a cyclometer, which measures mileage, or a hub lamp, which is a valuable accessory for a high-wheel bike. The hub lamps are worth more than the bicycles in many cases. And so he contacted a third party and came up with a hub lamp that was sent to me for my approval, and I decided to accept the offer.
Wow. Okay, so
now that bicycle is displayed in a new book by, I guess, Jim Hurley, called Bicycle.
David Hurley.
It's sort of the Yeah, David. It's sort of the frontispiece or the title page of the book.
Yeah, it's a beautiful hardback book, and it's a book. The author's name is David Hurley. The title of the book is called Bicycle. It's a beautiful book, and the first image you see is this bike that used to be Jack's. So if you want to see the quality of, get an idea of the kind of quality of stuff that Jack has, you might do well to get a look at that book. Okay, now you've got a whole bunch of bike memorabilia there, Jack, including posters that all over the walls and things like that. Tell us about this closet full of T-shirts that you have.
Well, there are a couple of guys in the club who make high-wheel bicycle-related T-shirts. They find old pictures or old advertisements or just design something on their own. And so I started buying these T-shirts, and you often get a T-shirt when you go to a bicycle meet, so I'd add that to the collection. Well, after a few years of that, it turned out that the wooden rod that you hang all these hangers on in my closet broke under the weight of all these T-shirts. There's at least 75 of them in there now. Uh-huh. So what I had to do was you can get these braces at your hardware store, so about every foot I have a brace now to hold that rod up. There's T-shirts in there that I've never worn. There are some that are too big for me, but I bought them because of the design. And then there are some when I go down to New Zealand, I'll need to take a sweatshirt down there. So I just go. I don't have another sweatshirt that's worth wearing. So I'll go in there and get one with a bicycle on it and take it down with me.
Great. How often do you travel to New Zealand and to Australia?
I went twice this year, but I'm gonna just go once a year.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've been doing for many years.
Okay.
Maybe, I think I've gone down there 10 times, 10 years.
And do you go to Europe very often, also anymore, or did you ever, or have you ever?
Well, I used to go back in the '60s and '70s, and then for a long time I didn't go anymore. And and I've been back there a number of times recently, but not always on bicycle activities.
Mm-hmm. Before we close up, I want to go back to your ride just for a moment, if we can. Jack, when you got when you replaced your wheel, had to have it retired, what state did that take place in?
Well, I did that more than one time. First time in Utah. I had some pretty good hard rubber on that bike, and I didn't realize that I was going to wear my tires out. Well, I didn't wear the front tire out. I think I could have gone around the world. That thing was a good tire that just didn't wear out. But the back tire did. And, of course, the back wheel has gone around about 3 times for every once of the front wheel. And I noticed before I got out of California that I was showing some wear on that back tire. Now, I hadn't even started out with a new tire. Didn't realize I was going to have this problem. But across Nevada, I was keeping an eye on it, and it was really wearing down. And when I got to Salt Lake City, I found a man who put tires on wheelchairs, and we put a tire on. But he didn't get it on very tightly, and it didn't last very long. And I started having the concern about it. He also gave me a spare to take along. And when I got into Nebraska, I was at the point where I was using electrical tape to keep the tire on the rim. And there is a picture of me going through Grand Island, and you can see the tape on the rear wheel. Now, that was okay until, you know, it would last a while. You put several windings on there, and I mean on top of each other, and then between every two spokes I had it. But it turned out that when I got into rain, that electrical tape just lets go. and I ran into rain in Columbus, Nebraska, and it was a real problem. Well, when I got over into Iowa, I was met by the 8 fellows who rode later behind me with they had a SAG vehicle with them, and they were just coming west, and I was in Iowa, and I met them in Greenfield, Iowa, and they had a little fixture, and they put a tire on for me. much more tightly. And that was good. And then when I got to Lowell Kennedy's in Defiance, Ohio, we put one on for good. And Lowell could really put a tire on tightly. And Lowell passed away here just a few years ago, but he made Highwheel bicycles of pretty good quality for many, many years.
Okay, so what kind of rubber were you using on that Highwheel that you were so successful with?
I think that tire was on the bicycle when I bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out of Wisconsin, and it was a very hard red rubber with a wire running through it, and you have to have a fixture to hold the rubber back while you draw the wire very tightly and put on a brazed joint or silver solder. And I think that tire was on the bike when I got it, and it was a really hard rubber. We had Lowell Kennedy put rubber on bikes, and so did Dick Hamill. And Dick Hamill was most popular for that. He would go to the wheelman meets, and he would do tires for hours while he was at the meet. And Dick has passed away, and his son-in-law, Ray Rittenhouse, has taken over the business. And the last time I had Ray put a tire on, he was still in the learning process. But there aren't many people who do it. They'll do it down in Florida at Victory Bicycles, too. And I believe Jim Spillane can probably do it up in Connecticut. But we don't have very many people who do it.
Mm-hmm. How often did you true that wheel on the ride?
Never.
Never true?
I never tightened a spoke on a whole 3,341 miles. I never tightened a spoke.
Wow.
I lubricated the bike about once a week. And usually what I do is go to a gas station and ask them if they had a needle nose fitting to go on their grease gun. And we just put that up against the holes in the bearings and just shoot grease in. We'd fill the whole rear axle and the two front bearings. And then I would take the backbone out of the head, clean it up with a paper towel, and we'd shoot some lithium grease in the head there.
Well, Jack, we've reached that point in our show where I can't overload our listeners with any more Jack Castor No Limits excitement. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, just a few of the things I've enjoyed doing with a bike over the years. It's enabled me to travel and meet people in other countries, and I've really enjoyed that. In addition to riding across America, I've ridden across England. I joined a tour there, and we took a week to ride across England. I've ridden a little bit in Holland. I went to an international bicycle meet in Belgium a couple of years ago and rode there. I've ridden in Australia and New Zealand. And bicycle people are a lot of fun all over the world, I really look forward to going back and seeing some of these people again.
All right. Indeed, it was an honor and a treat talking with you today, Jack. With that said, I just got to say thanks, and we'll see you on the road.
Okay.
All right, Jack. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Bye. That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.